This is a recording with Jerry McCarthy about his role as a swan upper. It was recorded on February the 12th, 2024, by volunteers Sophie Bellamy and Carson Zayner for the Making More Mischief Oral History Project.
All right, and we are recording, so I'll just give a little introduction. My name is Carson Zayner. I'm here with Sophie Bellamy. We are joined today by Jerry McCarthy for the Making More Mischief Project. In collaboration with London College of Fashion and put on by the British Folklore Museum. So we'll just get started. If you could introduce yourself to start, just your name and...
Yep, my name's Jerry McCarthy. I'm the barge master and beadle of the Dyers Company. And when I say barge master, I'm basically the man in charge of the swans for the Dyers Company in London.
Amazing. And so we'll just kind of go back to the very beginning and just tell us a bit about where you were born and brought up and kind of early influences.
Yeah, I was born 1968, 56 year old, and I was born and brought up in Blackheath, South London, top of Greenwich Park. Went to school at Blackheath and Bluecoats in Blackheath. And then when I left school, I was apprenticed in 1985 to the River Thames for 5 years as a Thames waterman and lighterman, which qualified in 1990. And basically, yes, all my life I've been a Thames waterman and lighterman on the Thames. That includes, I was captain of the Woolwich Ferry for 6 years, tugs, barges, pleasure boats, mooring up of ships. Yes, and I'm semi-retired now, but I do still work on the Thames, and obviously my other job is with the Dyers Company in a ceremonial role most months.
Amazing.
And what drew you to that profession? Do you have a family connection to the Thames?
Six generations, yep. And within that, my nephews, three of my nephews work on the river. I apprenticed my youngest son 2 weeks ago. I'm Thames waterman. My father, my granddad, my great-granddad, and my great-great-granddad are all Thames watermen and lightermen. Yeah, so it goes back six generations. So it's the only thing I was ever going to do, really. Destined for nothing else.
Do you have any early childhood memories of kind of going out on the water with your father or your grandfather?
No, my dad left the river in 1972 when, I mean, this area we're in at the moment and Canary Wharf, it was in the late 60s, early 70s, was a hustle and bustle of barges, ships, warehouses. You know, this was the larder of London where all the food but in the decline of containerisation, the work on the river really dropped out, and so my father left the river in 1972 and became a teacher. Yeah, he trained as a PE teacher, and for the rest of his life then he was a teacher till he retired.
Just going back, can you tell us what containerization is?
Containerization is all of the goods that came into the Royal Docks, the warehouses that are all along the river and up through the Limehouse Cut and into this area we are at the moment. It was all brought in by ships, and it was loaded into barges. They're called lighters, because when you put the goods from a ship into these barges, the ship gets lighter in the water, and a man that looks after those barges is a lighterman. So a waterman carries passengers, a lighterman carries cargo. But it was a very labour-intensive industry. But obviously, you see all the ships that travel around the world now, everything is in containers. And once containerisation became popular in the early 70s, the early 80s, it just cut out all the amount of men that was needed. It was so much quicker, it was so much easier. You come over on ships, onto the back of a lorry, onto a train, and whisked away, other than loading it into barges, then taking it to warehouses, unloading it on trucks. So, yeah, the decline of the River Thames basically happened in the early 70s, early 80s, and that's when, I mean, all the warehouses are gone now. There's the only cargo that comes into the Port of London now is down at the Gateway and at Tilbury Docks, way downriver in form of containers.
Wow. And so I guess from there, obviously you were talking about your dad retiring, and you talked about when leaving school, kind of that was just the next move. So could you tell us kind of about those first experiences within your work and what you were doing?
Yes, I'd when I left school, I had I've got two brothers. My oldest brother's disabled, so he was he's got cerebral palsy, so he was never to be able to, unfortunately, work on the river. And my middle brother, he didn't work on the river because the river was dying out. There was no work out there. So my dad said, look, you know, there's not really much for you out there. And he went on to become a money broker. He worked in the city. But then when I left school, the trade was just starting to pick up slightly, with Canary Wharf being built and civil engineering. So I said to my dad, you know, I would like to work on the river. And so I did. And my first job in 1985 was for Livitz Launches, and I was an apprentice on a rubbish barge. So I worked on the rubbish barges, worked there for a couple of years. Then I left and went on to some tugs and barges, mooring up of ships at Cherry Garden Pier, working on the pleasure boats. And then I left the industry for a year to row for Doggett's Coat and Badge, which is the oldest rowing race in the world. So I won that in 1990. And then when I went back to work, I went back to the tugs and then just literally floated around on the river all my life, going from job to job. The longest I was employed was for 12 years on the Woolwich Ferry. I was captain for 6 years, then I went in the office and I was the manager. And then, got married, children come along, and times changed again. So at the moment now I'm semi-retired and I only work for a company called Livitz Launches now, which do a little bit of civil engineering and a lot of film work. So, I just do a couple of days a week for Chris.
Mm-hmm. Very cool.
And so how did you get involved with the dyers?
Traditionally the dyers, the Swan Uppers, there is the Dyers Company and the Vintners Company, the two livery companies, along with the Monarch, that are allowed to own swans on the Thames, and they have been allowed since 1471. And traditionally, the way the birds are caught is six men row up the river from each company in traditional skiffs and catch the birds. So traditionally, because they was rowing for skiffs, they would use Thames watermen because they was the most skillful people to do the job. So back in 1996, the Dyers Company, one of their barge master retired, and one of Davy Reed from the dyers stepped up as barge master. So there was a position available in the Dyers Company, and there hadn't been for probably 30 years, because when I joined they was all 70-year-old men that had been doing this job for years and years. And then a gentleman down the rowing club, Harry Reed, who went swan up in, just approached me one day and said, there's a position come up swan up in, would you be interested? You know, we know you can scull and row and you might know a couple of the boys and we think you'll fit in, would you like to do it? I said, I'd love to do it. So I was invited in 1996, and 27, 28 years later, here I am still doing it. Yeah, so it was through invitation, basically, and that's how it still is. If a position comes available, we think of who's somebody who can row, somebody who's good with the public, somebody who can work well in a team, enjoys a beer, is very sociable, you know, and can spend sitting in a boat with someone for a week. So yeah, you're just invited, really, from the company.
So there's a real kind of community then that is related
I mean, in the Dyers Company, Gary, Rob, I mean, we've all worked together and we've all known each other since we was kids, and the same for the Vintners Company. Well, not so much for the King's Company, because they use people that work way upriver, lots of boat builders. But when you get to meet them, they're like-minded, they're from the water community. And though there is three companies, we all get on. It's all one big company, really, Swan Up In. So, yeah, we all get on very, very well.
And so how does the Swan Upping aspect relate to kind of the dyers' larger work?
The many, many people used to own swans on the Thames back in the 1300s, 1400s, and at the head of any medieval banquet, there was always a brood of swans. It was a sign of wealth to own swans, so everybody used to, lots, there was, I think it's about 350 people was owning swans, and they would mark their birds in all different ways on their beaks with elaborate marks. But back in 1471, because the swan was such a a sign of wealth and head of the banquet, the monarch at the time decided to take ownership of all the swans. But he granted, obviously, at every medieval banquet, other than the food, one of the most important things is the wine. So the vintners was offered a royalty. And those very beautiful, colourful occasions and all the tapestries around the medieval banquets, if you can imagine, they was all dyed by the Dyers Company. So we was given our royalty in 1471 to own swans on the Thames. And still to this day, the only people now that are allowed to own swans on the Thames are the monarch, the vintners and the dyers. The monarch owns the swans all over the country on open water, but they only, not the queen anymore, the king now will only claim ownership of Thames swans on the River Thames. He only exercises his right on the Thames. So in theory, all the other swans are the monarch's, but he doesn't exercise right to ownership. So it's they stopped eating swan when the turkey was introduced into this country. That's what, once the turkey was introduced, the swan was then seen as obviously a regal bird and a sign of wealth and protection. So the swan fell out of favour, the cygnet, and turkey was the saviour of the swan. There you go.
That is so interesting.
That is really interesting. So obviously you had mentioned about them making the marks on the beaks, and that was kind of how things were.
Yeah, the first year I went swan up in, they still marked the birds. So the last time we marked the birds was in 1996, and how they marked the birds was you would hold the bird, and you'd get a scalpel, and they would take a nick out the side of the beak of the bird, one nick for the dyers, and one nick either side for the vintners. And then it didn't hurt the birds because it's like having your fingernails cut, really. So, and then we'd put a little bit of Stockholm tar, which is an old-fashioned anaesthetic. And then when you caught the birds later on, you would hold the bird, and as you would run your finger down the beak, you could feel the nick on the beak. But that was the last year that they stopped marking the birds. And before that, they used to pinion the birds. They stopped that in the 1950s, where they would cut the last lot of flight feathers from the cygnet so the bird couldn't fly, and so it would stay in an area. But they stopped doing that in the 1950s because it was cruel. And then they started to want to move on from marking the birds. So what we did, we started then putting rings on the birds. So I've got one in my pocket which I can show you later. So they're all numbered. So the first bird that we rang was 001, and it's got the Dyers Company on it. And so when we catch the birds now, we put a ring, if we are giving a bird, we put the ring on the leg of the bird, and I keep a note. And it's brilliant because you can build up a family tree of, you know, if you catch number. This year I was up, so since 1997, last year I think it was 991, so we've had nearly 1,000 birds in 20 odd years. So when you catch a bird now and it has a ring on it, I can say, right, number 753, I can look in my book and say that was caught at Sunbury in 2008. So it's brilliant because you can keep a track of where the birds move. But no, they're no longer marked. They're now we put a ring on the left leg, and Professor Perrins, he puts a ring on the right leg. And Professor Perrins is the Professor of Ornithology at Oxford University. And he was the man that discovered it was lead shot that was poisoning the birds back about 30 years ago. They was only catching 5, 10, 15 birds a year. And what it was Chris Perrins discovered that swans are bottom feeders, and lead shot from fishermen was being ingested into the birds and killing them of lead poisoning. So he was the man that got lead shot banned on British waterways, and they did that, and then literally 5-6 years later the numbers shot straight back up to 90, 100, 120 birds a year. So he goes every year and he will mark the right leg and we mark the left leg, obviously if the Queen's birds are unmarked. So it's only the vintners and dyers that put a ring on. David Barber, who is the King Swan marker, none of his birds are marked, so they're left. So,
do you know why that is?
Well, because traditionally, we marked on the beak. So if you found a bird with no marks on the beak, that was a royal bird. So when they went over to rings, they decided that we will put the rings on, because then if you see a bird with no ring on its left leg, then it is a royal bird. So if we catch, in the 26 years that I've been swan upping, we average, I think it's about, when I looked at the records before I came, it's about 108 to 110 birds a year. The most I've had is 172, the least I've had is 71. It goes in fits and starts. Floodwaters might have washed the nests away, and it might be a second nesting. Nowadays we get a lot of mink attacks, red kite has come in, pike, dog attacks, you know, so it but on the whole, the there's about 2,800 swans on the Thames. So it's this year we had bird flu, which obviously a few of the birds was cold, but the they're doing well, their numbers are up, and they're not in any danger at all. Or so if we catch, say, 100 cygnets, 50 will go to the king, 25 to the vintners, 25 to the dyers. It's split half, a quarter, and a quarter. So if when we catch the bird, you have 4 cygnets, it will be 2 for the king, 1 for the vintners, 1 for the dyers. If there's 5, it will be 2 for the king, 1 for the vintners, 1 for the dyers. And then whatever mum is, the pen, that odd bird will go. So if the pen is a dyer, then we take the extra bird. That's how it works. But the numbers even out to half, a quarter, quarter.
And going kind of back, can you actually describe to us what swan upping is and what it looks like? So the kind of, you know, we've been talking about the specifics of it now, but kind of, more generally, what it looks like, how it happens, when it happens.
Yep, it happens traditionally in the third week of July. Swans nest in... Mum starts building her nest about February time, and she will build a nest, and then March, April time, she lays up to about 8 eggs, and she will lay 1, and then the following day she will lay 2, following day she will lay 3, and on the 8th day, once all the eggs are laid, she will then incubate, and she does that so she hasn't got swans hatching all over the place. So when we catch the birds, they're about 2.5-3 months old, and they're the big grey ones you see. They're just starting to look like mum and dad, but still very grey, and that's traditionally when birds was eaten at that young age. You can't really eat a mouse, a fully grown swan. They're very tough, very, you know, tough meat. So and then we catch them in July, and then those cygnets will stay with mum and dad till about October, November, and that's when mum and dad will say, right, come on, we've brought you up, off you go, push you out, and they literally drive the young out because they can fly then. If most of the birds will go, if one of the cygnets refuses to go, mum would drown it, because she's wanting to move on to next year, and so those young birds will fly away. And then on the Thames, when you see those big flocks at Windsor, Staines, Reading, they're all juvenile birds. They're only 2 years old. So they join a flock for 2 years because they're safe in numbers. And after about 3 years, they think, right, I'm fully grown up, and they fly off and find a mate. And so then mum and dad stay on their own from October till February, and the circle starts again. But when you see swan upping, it's traditionally 6 boats, 2 for the king, 2 for the vintners and 2 for the dyers. Anyone that's never seen swan upping before would look at it and think, my God, what on earth is this? It's a very colourful ceremony. The king's company wear red traditionally, the vintners wear white traditionally, and us, the dyers, we are blue, and blue and white traditionally. And we wear white trousers. Why we've always worn white trousers, I don't know, because they get covered in all sorts of stuff, which you can imagine. And we wear blazers for when we go to shore. And we on each of our boats, we fly our company flag, which has Dyer's Royalty, Vintner's Royalty, or the King's boat now has CR2 emblazoned on it. And the boats we use are traditional Thames skiffs. The boats we use are about 120 years old, and they are traditional watermen's boats. We row up the river, and when a flock of cygnets is spotted, we ignore just adults on their own, because in theory we've already caught those, so we're only interested in the cygnets. And we have, in each company, we have two boats. One boat's called a hack boat, because they hack off in front to find the swans. And the other boat is the governor's boat, which has the barge master in, which is our boat. And then when a boat sees a brood of cygnets, you will hear the cry of all up. Someone will shout all up, and that means all birds up off the water. So he will stop, just the first boat that spots it will stop. And then we all basically just row up behind, so we're all in a line. And then the top boat will go just above the birds and sort of usher them into the bank. And then the second boat will come in just inside the first boat. The third boat will come just inside the fourth boat. And then at the back, the king's boat will come in at an angle of 45 degrees. I will come in, and we all link up. So we've got the birds surrounded in the boats. And then what we do is what's called shorten up the boats. So we then start pulling the boats, so the circle gets smaller and smaller and smaller, until they're in a tiny little area where we can literally manhandle the birds, catch them, bring them into the boat. And then when we bring them into the boat, we tie their legs. They get a lot of power from their legs, and they have very sharp claws, which can, you know, a lot of swan uppers have got lots of scratches. So we tie their legs up behind them, tie their wings, and just with the cygnets, we don't need their wings because they're not fully developed. We tie their legs, and then we take them ashore. We weigh them, we measure them, we check them for fishing tackle. If when we weigh them, one's slightly light, why is that? As they got, we feel their throat. Sometimes they have a blockage in their throat. And we have a lady from Swan Support, Wendy Harmon, who follows us along. So if there's any birds that are not healthy, she will take them away and nurse them back. We put our rings on, we make note, and then this takes about 10 minutes just to do that. And then all the swan uppers get hold of one bird, we untie them, release them, and off they go.
So, you know, you have a background in obviously boats. How was the transition to then kind of handling the animals?
It was a wake-up call. When you first went, you think, oh, swan upping's good. But when you get there, you think, bloody hell, that means I've got to catch swans. And it is quite daunting, first of all. We have had some swan uppers where it's took them a couple of years to... But they are, they're renowned for, you know, they say swans can break your arm and stuff. They are obviously a very powerful bird, but the skill is you literally just, you will grab the neck. And as soon as you've got them, you just grab the wings, put your arm around them, and they calm down instantly, because they will flap about us, but you just get hold of them, tie their wings, and as soon as the young are alongside and they know that their young is not in danger, they calm down. But they normally start you off with the little fluffy ones, and then you gradually work your way up once you feel confident enough. Normally the first week my son came for the first time this year. We had William's 17. Chris hurt his shoulder, so he couldn't come, so William stepped in and we pushed him up the front. And after a couple of days, what we do is we'll tie a boat up and we'll let a new swan upper hold a bird that's already tied up, and then we will take the ties off, show them how to hold the wings and the legs and let them release them, so they're used to handling the bird. But yeah, you're thrown in at the deep end, you're pushed to the front and grab hold of it. There's always someone alongside you to help you. Yeah,
I guess kind of going from that, are there any specific memories of like funny stories or maybe malfunctions along this process as you guys are going along, or anything that you can recall?
There was, funny enough, it was one of the older birds that because we stopped marking in 96. So swans live for about, a good swan can live for about 14, 15 years. That's how long. And there was a couple of things. There was a bird at the campsite at Shillingford, and he was huge. He was a cob, and he was a biter. and you would nobody ever, and even when you tied him up, he weighed about 7 kilos. It was an enormous, beautiful cob. And I do remember when you'd catch him, in the end we had to tie, never have we had to do it before, but we used to have to tie his beak with a little bow, because he would literally just nip you and just hiss and never leave you alone. And the other, and that was Fred. Fred was in our company, and he actually served 70 years swan upping. He packed up when he was about 80. He came as a he was in the original King's Company during the war, and he was Freddie Reed. He was a very funny man. He just, you know, the stories he told for years. And then once he started getting a bit old, we used to put him in the back of the boat, and he was fine. And we got to swan up in 1 year, and there was a boat that we normally use the same boats every year, and our boat is a bit wider, because we lean out to catch the swans. And this year our boat got damaged, so we was given a different boat for that year, and it was a lot narrower, so obviously it was very, very unstable. So as you was leaning out, the boat was always tipping over and filling up with water. So we said, look, only one of us go for the birds, and the other two sit on the other side and we can work it. And we went up a little backwater to catch a brood, and we didn't quite get in the catch because it was so narrow, but unfortunately one of the birds got out, and just as we come past, we see it coming out, and then the King's swan marker, David Barber, shouted, there's a bird, quick get it. And we just naturally all leant to catch this bird. I held on, David held on, but Fred didn't. And Fred, I remember him falling in, but he fell in only from his waist up. So obviously when you fall in the water and you're standing there, you're going to be wet from the waist down. And Fred was underwater for about 5-6 seconds until we got the bat, and he come up just completely drowned with the bird in his hand. But we said he was the only swan upper ever that has managed to fall in and be wet from the waist up, not from the waist down. Yeah, so we always record that story. But now over the years, there's been, you know, people falling in, mostly people falling in. Yeah, especially after lunch.
Balance is a bit off.
So what's it like on the shore? Because when you're not in the boat, do you have traditions about places you go to or?
We start every year at Sunbury. We cover about 106 miles. We start at Sunbury on day one, on the Monday. We're based at the moment, we've been based all over, but at the moment we're based at Cookham. So that's where we all meet on the Sunday. We stay at Moore Hall, which is a conference centre. And then every morning a coach picks us up and takes us to the boat. And every evening the coach picks us up and takes us back to Cookham. And Cookham is in the middle of the week. So as the week goes on, the journey every morning gets shorter and shorter. And so we go from Sunbury to Windsor, day one. Day two we go from Windsor to Marlow. Wednesday we go Marlow to Sonning, Thursday is Sonning to Molesford, and then on the Friday is Molesford, and we finish at Abingdon. And that's 18 locks and 106 miles. And we row some of it, quite a lot of it, but we do have traditional Thames gentlemen's wooden boats that follow us to help us. So when we're this long pounds, we put a rope over the back and they tow us. Otherwise, you know, it's a long journey. Some of the swan uppers have rowed the whole 106 miles, but it's a long journey. And we start about 8 o'clock every morning. We set off about 8 o'clock, and we have set lunch stops every year where we, obviously, people that can cater for, you know, 20, 25 odd people. We stop for lunch normally about 1-2 o'clock. Have a nice lunch, then get back in the afternoon, and we're normally out of the boats by about 6 o'clock in the evening. And then traditionally on the way home, we always stop at a pub on the way home for a couple of hours, have a few beers. You know, sometimes some of the boys might sing songs, and you know, then the public know we're stopping there, and we've made friends over the years, and it's a lovely social event. Yeah.
How do members of the public interact with you?
Obviously, some that follow us know what we're doing and they're very interested. Some people look and think, you know, what on earth is going on here? But, and then, you know, the lads are all very good with the public. We encourage us, the barge masters, we have school groups of school children. Probably we do a little 10-minute talk on fishing tackle, what swans are, how they're born, and you know, just about 10 minutes. We do about 12 school parties a year. So we just stop for 10 minutes and there's groups of children on the banks. We chat to them. But any member of the public that is with us, yeah, we invite them to, you know, come in. If you want to give them a stroke, do you want to hold the signet? And just, and we have a brochure printed, which we hand out to the public, which explains photos and exactly what we're doing. Some people obviously think, oh my God, what are they doing? Is it this, that, and that? But once, obviously, we tell them what we're doing, and the big conservation drive that there has been over the last few years for the welfare of the swan, that's, you know, always welcomed.
That's amazing. I guess we'll kind of maybe talk now about what you wear when you guys are swan upping, and if you could just kind of describe in detail the different elements of what that looks like.
Yep. Me as the barge master, I wear a blue blazer with a silver swan badge on my arm, which dates back to 1790. That's the original silver blazer. We all wear a hat, which is traditionally similar to a captain's hat, and we actually put a large swan feather in our hat. Have you heard the saying, a feather in your cap? Mm. That's where it comes from. So it's a big white flight feather. I wear white trousers and black shoes, but I also have another uniform, a ceremonial uniform, which I only wear at Dyer's Hall for ceremonial dinners, and that is a traditional barge master's uniform from the livery companies, when all the livery companies used to have barges on the Thames. So a livery company is basically a group of individuals. The first livery company was 1188, the Weavers, in the City of London. They were bands of men that got together to protect their interests. So you've got mercers, dyers, grocers, salters, ironmongers, all the industries within the Thames. And they set standards for quality, for money. And so these livery companies grew, and you now have the Great 12. We are just outside, we're actually number 13. And each of these livery companies used to have a beautiful state barge, which every year for the Lord Mayor show, they used to row down the river. And in the Lord Mayor show, that's why they're called floats, because they used to float on the river. But the last Lord Mayor show is in 1846, when the embankment was built, and they took the barges, was no longer used, and they put the procession on the river. But the gentleman in charge would have a wonderful, beautiful, bright, very, very prestigious uniform, and that's the uniform I wear when I'm at Dyer's Hall for, we have about 5 or 6 dinners a year, and for the swan dinner every year, where we still exercise our right to eat swans, which we don't, we eat goose now, so that we stopped eating swan years ago. So that's my uniform, and then that's the same for the barge master of the vintners and the kings. The swan uppers will wear either white, red or blue t-shirts, a lighter shirt with white trousers. Some of them wear hats, bobble hats, little striped bobble hats. And traditionally the dyers for the last 50, 60 years have always been blue. But we did swap last year we now went back to the traditional uniform from the 1800s of blue and white stripes, because it was the 550th anniversary of the Dyer's Company last year. So we just decided to go back to our old traditions. So yeah, the barge masters wear blazers all the time. The swan uppers have got blazers, but they only wear them when we finish swan upping, we go to lunch, they will put their blazers on. They don't wear their blazers while they're swan upping. It's just basically blue t-shirts, because it's summer, it's nice and hot. But if it's raining, we've got wet gear, which is blue, white or red. And shoes wise, they will wear, traditionally they wore leather boots, but we just, I got the guys plastic Crocs, or, you know, old training shoes, that, because they're in and out of the water literally 10, 15 times a day. So yeah, Crocs are ideal actually.
Definitely.
Who don't like a pair of Crocs?
Yeah. I do.
Yeah, we wear the boat shoes, Crocs, they're brilliant.
And in terms of making changes to kind of the uniform, who makes that decision?
Well, we was at Swan Up in so our uniform that we went to stripes was last year. The year before, the dyers kindly, because it was 550th anniversary, gave the Swan Uppers. We had some lovely silver ashtrays made, and they was each given a bottle of champagne. Thank you very much, blah blah, to celebrate. And then we were just sitting there one night in the pub afterwards, looking back at photos of. If you Google Swan Up in, there is photos from the late 1800s. And Steve, one of our Swan Uppers, when did we stop wearing blue stripes? You know, I said, I don't know. We was chatting. And then lad said, well, why don't we go back? And I thought that'd be a good idea. So we muted the idea and thought nothing of it. And then when we met at the Swan Dinner in October, where we have it, we all sat again, and while we was having our dinner, it come up again. So I thought, yeah, it might be a good idea. So I approached our old clerk who retired last year, Mr. Vasey, and I said, I would be interested to go back to our original uniforms. What do you think? And he said, well, you're the barge master, you make the decision. And I said, well, would you make some? No. He said, that's brilliant. So I went away and sourced the new uniform. They're called Breton. They're traditional Breton shirts which are worn by fishermen. And I sourced a lady in Maidenhead, and she got them from France. They're French. And very similar also to the Russian Navy, the blue and white stripes. I sourced them, got them some long sleeve ones, you know, five or six for the week, in case one gets wet if you fall in. So the lad's got a couple of long sleeve ones, a couple of short sleeve ones. And they had their first outing this year, and it was well received. We got a bit of ribbing at the start, but no, they all agreed they look, yeah, they're quite striking.
And for the white trousers, when they get dirty, which I imagine they must, do you have to have a new pair every day, or is it just...
We get a new pair every day, yeah. Yeah, they do get, we call it spinach. Yeah, when you look at it, we call it spinach. And when you pick the birds, that's the first thing the bird does, is normally you'd learn a swan. When you catch a bird, point that end away from you, because sometimes you've got them in your lap and you look and it's just... So what you tend to do is just, you know, some of you just try and wash it off with, but it does stain. And if they're badly stained, we always carry a spare pair. So lunchtime, one of the lads will quickly, before he goes into to have lunch, swap to a new pair of trousers. But yeah, they're quite heavy cotton. Just traditional sailors' cotton trousers. So some of the trousers we've got are literally, must be 30 odd years old. So they're quite, so we tend to use now trousers for bowling, chef's trousers, anything that may be, but they're getting quite hard to source, but we've got many pairs. But as the lads get older, their waists get bigger, and we've only got some 34 inches, but they manage to squeeze into them.
But so you, as the barge master, you're in charge of having a big pile for everyone, with everyone's size.
Yeah, that's my... I've got big Tupperware boxes, big things. And so every year when we come back, I take all the blazers and everything to dry cleaners. We've got a little contractor, they clean it. And so every year in the box, I'll put... we swan up for 5 days, but I'll give them 7 T-shirts, 7 pairs of trousers, waterproofs. Each of them have a hat. Some of the lads like wearing a hat, some don't. They've got a blue gilet, so if it's a little bit chilly one morning. So each one of those boxes and their crocs, and then I load them all up in the car. They're all in the garage at the moment, all stored away. So every year when we go, each have got their name on it. Steve, Rob, there they go, and that's their gear for the week. Yeah, but it's my responsibility to look after the gear and get it cleaned.
Wonderful, yeah. And then
would you be able to also talk us through your barge master ceremonial outfit?
Yes. Yeah. It is there are 5 barge masters left. There is the vintner's barge master, the dyer's barge master, then there is the barge master to the waterman's company. There's the barge master to the fishmonger's company, and then there's the king's barge master. And strangely enough, mine is the only uniform that doesn't wear a hat. All the photographs that we look back into the 1800s, for what reason, and we've never been able to find out why, the barge master doesn't have a hat, but all the other barge masters traditionally have, if you can imagine the hat that Lord Nelson used to wear, the pointed hat with the thing, they all wear those, but I don't have a hat. And it's a blue jacket with lots of gold braid on the front. On the back is a big silver swan, which is embroidered onto the back. It's about 3/4 length, and underneath I wear red breeches, which come down to my knees and traditionally worn with white stockings. And then underneath I wear a white shirt with a white bow tie. And it's when you look at the uniform of the other barge masters, that is traditionally what the other barge masters wear.
Do you like wearing it?
I do like wearing it. I do. It is. I have two roles at the Dyer's Company. I was originally employed as the barge master, but the old barge master David, when he retired, he was also the beadle, and the beadle in a livery company. He's basically traditionally back 100 and sundry years, they was like a policeman. They would keep order at court meetings. If any arguments happened between other livery companies, the beadle had a truncheon and he would go in. There was known to be the old saying, sixes and sevens. That's when, have you heard the company, if you're at sixes and sevens with somebody, that's a livery company thing, because you had the great 12. Obviously one company wanted to be in the top six, so if you was in seven, so the sorters and the merchant tailors was at six, so every year now they swap round. But they had running battles in the street, so the beadle would go out and keep order. So then when David retired, I took over. I have both roles. So every month the dyers have a court meeting and I go up, I just wear a collar and tie, and I wear a blue full length gown with tassels. And my job as the beadle is to put the gowns on our prime warden and rent warden, put their badges on. Before they go into the court meeting, I will gavel and say, gentlemen, the wardens, I will escort the wardens in. I will put the flag up to say there's a court meeting. Just generally run the thing, and then I leave the meeting. And then sometimes in the meeting, if there are people being clothed in the livery, people are being given the livery, I will escort them in. So as a ceremonial role. But we also have five dinners every year. We had one just after Christmas, which was the livery dinner. And then, not this Wednesday, next Wednesday, we've got the masters and clerks dinner, when they will invite the master and clerk from other liveries. And that's when I put on that traditional uniform. Though I'm there in the guise of the beadle, because I'm also the barge master, it is quite nice to put that uniform on so that when other liveries come and see, it's, oh wow, there's a traditional. And then during that dinner, I gavel and run the dinner. So I will gavel for dinner. I will pray silence for the master to say grace. I gavel for when we traditionally drink out of a loving cup. I gavel a prime warden and rentor warden wish to have the pleasure of taking wine with you, being ever mindful of your comfort request, you remain seated. And then I gavel for guest speakers. So that's the role of the beadle cum barge master. At our five dinners a year, you run the dinner, make sure it runs to time. But my main job is obviously to organise Swan Up In, run Swan Up In, and to be the head of, in October when we have the Swan Dinner, that's when we have the church service in the morning to bless the Dyer's Company, and in the evening when the Dyer's Company exercise their right to eat swan, which obviously we don't anymore, we use a goose, we parade we've got an old stuffed cygnet, and we parade the all the swan uppers, we parade right round a big livery hall to our traditional Latin song, which dates back to about the 1700s, and then I march up and the prime warden has a speech, thank you barge master for your work well done, blah blah blah, pray let the cygnets be served, and we walk back out to the song. And then in the fourth course of the meal, that's when the swan is traditionally served. So that's probably the main role of the barge master every year, is to escort the banquet of swans, which we still celebrate every year.
And so you had mentioned too about the swan dinner. How does that, is that the most important dinner in the year?
Yes, yeah, so we have the livery dinner, we have the masters and clerks dinner, we have the summer dinner, the livery dinner, and the swan dinner. And that's the second, set every year, is the second Wednesday in October every year. So that's when traditionally, so the swans, the cygnets are about 5-6 months old, and that's when they was traditionally perfect for eating. They'd grown to their full size, the meat was perfect, and that's traditionally when they was eaten in October. I think the vintners have their swan dinner slightly later in November, but yeah, we always have ours in October.
And do you wear the ceremonial?
Yes.
For that?
Yeah, all the swan uppers come, and they're all in their traditional uniform. That's, they do wear their blazers. They're traditionally, some of us are King's Royal Watermen, and they can wear their medals, and they stand there with a flag and their oars. And the Dyer's Company are wonderful. You know, they, as they come in, they thank the swan uppers for their work well done. Because they know them, because a lot of them have been swan uppers for 20 odd years. And then we eat in the outmess, we have the same meal, and then yeah, about 9:30, 9:45, I'll go and see the chef, check everything's on timing, and we process in and pray, let the cygnets be served. Yeah,
it's amazing.
It's a wonderful ceremony. You know, my son, when he came this year, and a few years ago, about 2 or 3 years ago, I asked the clerk, my wife Nicola, could she come and sit in it? She said, of course, because Nicola said, you've been doing this thing for 12, and she was just like, wow, it's such a, you know, it's an ancient ceremony. And so I said to William this year, you know, he spent a week with a swan up in, and I said to him, what are you going to say to your friends when you get home? And he went, there is no point in me even trying to tell them what I've been doing for the last few days. And the ceremony, you know, I said, we had a little rehearsal, just stand here. And he said, that's just the most, you know, amazing, weirdest, it's been going on for hundreds of years. That's, you know, you can start a ceremony, but you've not got that 400 or 500 years of history. Yeah, it's amazing. And we don't have it in our hall, because our hall is too small. There's normally about 200 people, so we use one of the 5 big livery halls, fishmongers, merchant tailors, cloth workers, that can fit 200 people in, yeah.
It's such a fascinating different world, in a way, all the kind of livery companies and all the traditions that you have, that in so many ways we don't see replicated today. You entered the dyers through swan upping, but now, you know, you're involved in the dyers in so many more aspects. How has that been, entering the kind of livery world?
It's traditionally, obviously, I'm being a waterman and lighterman, I'm traditionally linked to the Waterman's Company. They're not a livery company. There's 2 companies that are not livery companies. That's the Waterman's Company and the Parish Clerks. It was said that they was never offered to be a livery company, because in the Great Fire of London, they charged people to row them ashore across the river. So that was frowned upon. But also, the traditional uniform of a waterman, the dog's coat and badge, they already had a livery. So, and the parish clerks obviously had cassocks. They didn't need it. So when I went into the Dyer's Company, yes, it was, you know, I met these gentlemen that had, you know, nothing to do with the river. And I must say now, I really don't have much to do with the Waterman's Company, because I feel very drawn to the dyers. And the majority of the dyers come from a dyeing background. And they are just, you know, wonderful people. They treat you, you know, they respect you, they're barge master, they look after you. They're all, every year we get a new master or a new prime warden, and you get to know the prime warden. And this year, our prime warden, he's involved in the dyeing industry. He's famous for a certain colour purple, which he's introducing onto the master's or prime warden's cloak this year. So yeah, they're wonderful people, and they're traditionally all from not directly involved in it, or their father was involved in the dyer's industry. But yeah, they, you know, they're a wonderful company. They do a lot for charity. They do a lot for schools. They promote the dyeing industry. They're still very active in promoting the dyeing industry and keeping the name alive.
That's amazing. Obviously, you talked again about the like your experience and kind of the generations throughout your family on the water, how is that experience sharing it with your son now and that kind of being passed on from there?
Yeah, it was lovely. It was, I say, when Christopher hurt his shoulder a couple of weeks beforehand, I thought, right, you know, how do I find... And my oldest son, Oliver, 20, he was ideal to start, but he joined the Merchant Navy. You know, he's gone, got water in the blood, obviously, but Oliver's joined the Merchant Navy, so he wasn't around, and William wants to join the Merchant Navy, so they've not gone down the Thames route, they've gone... So Oliver wasn't around, so I looked at William sitting on the settee and said, right, come on.
What do you mean?
Yeah, so off we took it. It was lovely to have him there. Yeah, traditionally, the Dyers of the Reed family, Freddie Reed, who did it for 70-odd years, then his nephew David took over, was barge master and beadle. When David retired, I took over. But we still have Joe, David's son. And Joe's a Merchant Navy. He's captain of the cross channel ferries, so he's a merchant mariner. So he still comes every year. So it is quite, within the Dyers, it is quite a family. So it's quite nice now that I managed to get William to, you know, that's another McCarthy coming along. So yeah, it is. Well, I don't think Oliver might not be around for, but we, you know, we've got a pool of, we need six people, but we've now got seven on that we use. So if some of the lads, because they run their own businesses, you know, they've got young children, so they might only do 3 days and have 2 days off. So I can always fit a pool of, you know, seven guys that can fit into six who know what they're doing.
That's amazing. I guess we'll move forward and kind of talk about how you feel about Swan Upping being included in an exhibition like this, and maybe also why you think this tradition might be considered folk or something worth being included.
No, it's wonderful. I mean, it's because I would think, what percentage of the public, when you ask them what Swan Upping is, they obviously know what a swan is, but they wouldn't know what Swan Upping is. There's been a big drive since David Barber took over as the King's Barge Master, a big drive on conservation, to look after the swans, to educate people to how they live, what they do, the role they've played in history. So anything we can do to publicise Swan Upping, to understand what it's about and to get people interested in it, it's a good thing. And it's one of those things, it's been going on for 600, 700, 800 years. It's incredible. You know, when we row up the river, we use these boats that are 100 years old. And on the last 2 days, Monday to Wednesday, we have a lot of press follow us. So this year we had Clear Boarding, Tales from the Riverbank. So yes, it's been involved in your exhibition, but foreign television follows all the time, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. We're always doing interviews and there's cameras. But on the last 2 days, there's no cameras follow us, and it's really nice to then switch off. And we row up the river, and I sometimes sit there, and when we're on the upper reaches where you're in this floodplain where there's just cows, no houses, and you're sitting in boats that are 120 years old, and you look, and it's like a time capsule. And other than you may have, yeah, you'll be looking at a pair of Crocs or a plastic water bottle. If you take that out of the picture, you look around you, and you think, this is exactly what it was like 120, you know, when you look, you can't see any telegraph wires or power stations. We always think, you know, this is exactly what it was like. But yeah, no, to publicise and get it out, then let people know what we actually do, it's a good thing.
Were you surprised, though, that when you were contacted for this exhibition about specifically the costume and also it being at a fashion college, would you expect people to be interested more in kind of the costumes as well?
I was surprised when I think, you know, why do they want to know? But then when you look at the uniform that we've got, I can understand that it is quite a unique uniform. It's quite a traditional uniform. So on one hand, what do people want to know? But when you look at, obviously, the reason for, you know, being in the college and the exhibition, I can understand why. Because it is quite, you know, people will see it is quite a traditional and unique uniform.
What do you think about it being considered folk?
It is. I mean, when you look at a folk is connected to tradition, isn't it? But anything that is, you know, as I've said before, 700 years of, there's not many traditions that go, but other than the royal family and some of the things with the Doomsday Book, it's Swanup and is one of the oldest traditions in this country. It's incredible.
That's amazing. So I guess we'll move forward as far as, you know, reflections and the future of Swanupping. How has this kind of impacted your life as a whole, as far as, you know, again, obviously you've had an experienced life on the water, and what does specifically Swanupping and the Dyers, how has that kind of impacted your life?
It's enabled me to go Swanupping every year, obviously, which is when you think there's only, 18 Swanuppers, so it's a very unique privilege. It's a privilege to be involved with the history of the Dyers Company. Obviously, though I have my role, you know, they employ me to do my job. But within that, you get to sample some wonderful food, some wonderful wine, to see beautiful traditions, to understand the roles that livery companies, not only the Dyers, but all livery companies do in the City of London. They do a lot of charity work. They don't publicise it, they just go about doing their thing. But it's enabled me, I say I'm semi-retired, every month, sometimes twice a month, I look forward to going up to the Dyers Company, to meeting the people. And sometimes I get involved in being interviewed. And over the years, yes, there has been a few exhibitions. We've been asked to go and just to be present when, a school's been opened. So yeah, it gives you sometimes you find yourself in positions that you wouldn't normally be in if it wasn't for Swanupping. It has opened a few doors for us, which is wonderful.
That is wonderful. And obviously you talked about the kind of emphasis and the importance of conservation in the last few years and decades, and how do you think that kind of will evolve the tradition of Swanupping, obviously?
It's conservation that will keep Swanupping going, definitely. Yeah, I mean, conservation is a big thing nowadays. And from when I explained earlier that the lead shot was killing the birds off, to if it wasn't for the Swanuppers, they wouldn't have known what it was, and so that was discovered. So yeah, every year there is always a big push with conservation, is making sure. And this year, with the bird flu, a lot of people, on the back of COVID, there was a lot of hysteria. Oh my God, bird flu! This, that, and that. Whoa, slow down. Only about 2 people have ever died from bird flu. Yes, it affects the birds. It can't be transferred to humans. I think it's under a certain temperature. But yes, it affects the birds, but it doesn't affect the humans. So, a lot of people this year, we were saying, yes, the birds, you could tell when a swan had, we had 2 of our birds culled. I think there was about 30 or 40 birds that was culled, but they were seriously ill. But it wasn't nowhere near as devastating as what was people's perception of. So that was good this year to go out and say, yes, we've had bird flu, but as you can see, look, I think you've caught 91 birds this year. On the back of bird flu, people said, oh, there's so many. Yes, there are. So it gives us a good opportunity to promote it in a good way, not perhaps what sometimes you might read in the media or people's perceptions of what could be going on.
How has being involved with Swanupping changed your own relationship with the water?
It's quite easy because I've 35 years I've been working out there. I'm semi-retired now, and after a while you can get a bit. So I've got to go to work tomorrow, and it's cold, isn't it? Oh, here we go. But it does, when you're out there, Swanupping, it does make you realise that if it wasn't for the fact that I was a Thames waterman and lightsman and the River Thames, I would not be doing this. So every year we do always say it. If it wasn't that the fact we didn't get apprenticed, we wouldn't be sitting here. So it just keeps you in check and realises that, yeah, because you are a Thames waterman and lighterman, you have been chosen to do this job. And so it does keep you connected. It's very easy, like any job, after a while. But you know, at the end of Swan Upping, we've had a great week, had a few beers, caught some swans, met some wonderful people. It just thinks, yeah, if it wasn't for old Father Thames, we wouldn't be here.
And kind of in more generally, beyond conservation, how do you see the tradition developing?
It can't really develop any more than what it is. Every year we have, next month we have a meeting with the barge masters and the livery companies to discuss the following year. And as I say to David Barber, why do we have this meeting? Because every single year it's exactly the same. No, we need to get together to check that this... and there might be a little thing that happened, but Swan Upping is Swan Upping. We row up the river, and that's how it's always been. Yes, now the media are more involved, which is, it is a good thing because it promotes it. But how it stands at the moment, it can't grow anymore. All we can do is just obviously promote it so that more people hear about Swan Upping and understand that, yes, it does go on in the third week. But going forward, all we can do is just keep looking after the birds, keep promoting it and keeping it in a good light.
And why do you think it is important that it carries on, the tradition carries on?
Because of the swans. You do get attached to them. You know, they are a beautiful animal. They are, you know, every time you see a swan swimming down the river, you will always look at it, won't you? You won't look at a coot or a duck or a... But when you see a swan, and us personally, obviously, we are attached to the birds. And when... one of our birds might have flown into a power line, had a dog attack, or, you know, a dead swan has been found and Wendy will find it and she'll say, look, you know, number 473 has been found. It's one of your birds. It's, you do feel attached to them. You do, and you care for them, you look after them, and we all feel quite attached to the swans. But they are a beautiful, traditional, regal bird. There's no bird quite like the swan.
Well, that's amazing. I think we'll kind of wrap things up. I just, as a final, you know, question, if there's anything that you wanted to, any final thoughts or anything that you wanted to share as like your legacy through this interview, if there was anything else you felt like maybe we missed that you wanted to mention.
No, it's been lovely to come here because it gives us, the Swan Uppers, an opportunity to promote Swan Upping. And if it can, it's all about education and conservation. And if we can, just a few people that come through and watch your exhibition and think, you know, what's that uniform, what's that? And then to go away and, you know, just keep it and promote it. Definitely promote Swan, because we want it to keep going, obviously. But, and it will do. It will never go away. It won't. But it's been here 800 years. I think it's going to last a few more years now.
I agree.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. And we've loved learning about it. It's,
we left to come Wednesday. Wednesday's a good day to come and watch Swan Upping. It's on the Henley Reach, and we're always gathered in, so you can walk down the course, halfway down the Henley rowing course. We're there about 12:00, and then you can walk up and see us. There's normally two or three catches in the Henley Reach, and you can see the birds being caught. We go ashore at Leander Rowing Club in Henley to have dinner, and there's always a brood there, and you'll see the school kids and the swans. So yeah, put it in your diary.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much, we appreciate it.
Just for the recording, so we were just sat after the interview talking and reflecting on folk, and yeah, Jerry has some additional thoughts about it.
We're just, when you're saying for the exhibition, you have Pearly Kings and Queens, you have Morris dancers. Reflecting on it, a lot of what traditionally is folk is what people would do for pleasure, for within groups of people that get together for partying, for folk music. Whereas, yes, Swan Upping is connected with folk because we're traditionally working class. We don't actually get paid for Swan Upping. We do, but it's a minimal thing. We would actually pay to do it. So I'd say the only thing where it's not slightly, it's done for a reason, for the livery companies who are very, very wealthy. But traditionally, it's working class men that have done Swan Upping, And yes, it is folk because we do it for the pleasure of doing it now. We're not doing it for monetary gain. We're not doing it for any other reason that we love being involved in swan upping. So there is that connection with folk. But when you say Pearly Kings and Queens, your Morris dancing, folk musicians, it's purely for pleasure and not for monetary gains. So that's probably where the only slightly it crosses over. But I'd say yes, it is folk because we do it for the pleasure. We do it because we want to be involved in it and enjoy socialising, you know, amongst ourselves. Mm. Yeah.
I think there is also that sense of responsibility about carrying on a tradition as well.
Pearly Kings and Queens, Morris dance, they are so passionate, and rightly so, that, you know, Pearly Kings and Queens goes back in families, doesn't it? And, you know, and Morris dancers, you see, in the village that I used to live in, West Peckham, there was a folk, a Morris dancing festival every year, and I didn't realise there was folk dancers with black faces, there was folk dancers with pheasant feathers, folk Morris dancers in uniforms which you like, long black cloaks. And afterwards, when you got chatting to them, it's, you traditionally have this, you know, pig's bladder and the bell with the flowers, but it goes a lot deeper than that. It's not until you afterwards, when you chatted to them, that a lot of it goes back to paganism. And, you know, when you try and when they try and explain what is paganism, that's, you know, it's very, it goes back again hundreds and hundreds of years. And it's lovely that these people are still gathering together to keep these traditions going, because if they don't, they die out.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Yeah, that was a wonderful